The topic before us, as you know, is a non-dualistic interpretation, non-dualistic approach to devotion. You know, in the history of religious philosophy, you can find two broad streams. The one, the approach to God as an anthropomorphic being who creates this world, who protects his creation, who listens to their prayers, and who shows his grace, pardons the sins, and bestows his blessings on his devotees. This is the one approach. And this is common to all traditions. This is a mainstream religion. When we talk about religion, we are actually, in a broad sense, we are talking about this. The other approach is a higher approach. Not that it is more correct, but rather it is a state of higher spiritual evolution. Now, one very central, vital point in non-dualistic philosophy is this, and that's very, very important, in fact. That is, if your approach to God is different from my approach, it doesn't mean, it never means that you are wrong, that I am right. Difference doesn't imply that you are wrong or that I am wrong. What it implies is it is another approach to the same truth. If A is correct, for that reason you cannot say B is wrong. B could be equally right, only B could be another approach to the reality, but a slightly different approach from A, that's all. Now, this concept, in fact, if you look at the history of interfaith conversations, it is this approach that gives justification to interfaith dialogue. Even the very concept of interfaith harmony doesn't find its full justification, philosophically or spiritually, unless we accept the fact that if your approach is different, it never means that your approach is wrong. Rather, it is another approach. So, diversity is a reality. Pluralism is a reality. But there is a unity within diversity. This is a central point in Advaita or non-dualistic system. Now, this ideal cannot find full philosophical or logical justification in devotional philosophy. This is an interesting point you have to remember. If you look at the history of the world, you find there have been more bloodshed, wars and battles and violence in the name of God and religion till 20th century. In fact, in 20th century, we had these diabolical political ideologies like Nazism, fascism, communism, and so on. I'm talking about that revolution aspect of communism, not the humanistic socio-economic political thought system, but rather the revolutionary dimension of communism. I mean, so much of bloodshed, so much of violence, and so much of intolerance in the name of highly divisive, violent political ideologies characterized 20th century. The Bolshevik Revolution, the communist movement, fascism, Nazism, and so on. But till 20th century, if you look at the history of human civilization, most of the wars were fought by devotees of God. In the name of God, and in the name of religion. Now, how do you justify this? Because people thought their God is the right God and all other gods are wrong. So their approach, their religion is right and all other religions are wrong. This happened all over the world. Even within India, which is the home of Advaita, you find there have been a lot of intolerance between different theistic dualistic systems. Vaishnava, Shakta, Shaivas, and so on. So, the idea that your path is different from my path, but it doesn't mean that your path is wrong and my path alone is right, it can find a full justification only in Advaita or non-dualistic system. That's why Sri Ramakrishna in the Gospel says, it's very interesting, at the highest experience level, when a devotee transcends the dualistic, the so-called mainstream devotional structure, he identifies himself with the absolute reality God, and the God whom he's searching outside in the temple or a church or any place finally is seen and experienced to be the immanent reality residing within him, his own heart. So we begin by searching for God in temples and churches, and finally we find that God sitting in our own heart. If we close our eyes to the presence of God within our hearts and focus on the God sitting in the temples only, then that God will look the other way. So that is why, you know, in the Bhagavata Purana, is a very famous devotional classic, not an Advaitic classic to be precise. It's a devotional classic. There is a great definition of who is the highest devotee. The highest devotee is not one who is always doing puja or praise or writing out checks as donations. The highest devotee is one who feels the presence of God in the hearts of all creation and who feels the presence of the whole creation in God. So all of us live in God, and God is the immanent inner resident living in our hearts. This experience is the characteristic of a most highly enlightened devotee. Sarva bhudeshu yapasyet bhagavad bhavam atmanaha bhudani bhagavadi atmani esha bhagavadottamaha. So bhagavadottama means, let us say, mystic. A devotee of God who has prayed for decades, who has read the scriptures, and finally, who feels the presence of God everywhere. That's a devotee. Bhagavadanam Uttama, Bhagavadottama. The highest devotee is one who sees God everywhere and who sees everything in God. Means experiences the presence. And the lowest devotee's picture also is given. Archayam eva kharaye pujam cha siddhaye kade nachatad bhakteshu channeshu yakkarodi sa prakritaha. O prakrita sa udakritaha. There are two versions. I mean, a person who goes to a temple or a church or a synagogue or any place of worship every day, read the scriptures with great apparent devotion mechanically, and who for all practical purposes appears to be a devotee of God, but who refuses to see the presence of that God outside the temple. When he comes, when he returns from the temple, then he sees only devils everywhere. So, or he sees something else. So God is somebody who is sitting in a small house, in a structure called a temple or a church. That's okay, but that is like a child who goes to a kindergarten and who says, this is the highest level of education. So prakrita means prakrideke prathama bhava. The first stage in evolution is called a kindergarten. So that's why Sri Ramakrishna says, at the experience level, at the highest experience level, devotion, bhakti, and jnanam, knowledge, that is non-dualistic philosophy, are the same at the experience level. If we remain devotees without this focus on the higher identity with God, who is residing everywhere, and if we limit our devotion only to seeing God in a place of worship or some rituals, then that devotion can even become fanaticism. Maybe I think 2 weeks back, I was giving a lecture on Martin Luther. 500th anniversary we celebrated. Martin Luther was the one who was supposed to be the forerunner of anti-Semitism in Europe. Martin Luther. So we can say great religious reformer. But though he was a religious man, his concept of religion did not make him broad-minded to see the presence of God in other races. And he was the one who was actually responsible for instigating the burning at stake of another Protestant. His name was Cervantes. He was a Spanish theologian who was a Protestant who differed from Martin Luther. But he instigated. In fact, there was a confrontation. The Catholics in France wanted him to be handed over to them. They will have the privilege of burning him at stake. But Martin Luther wanted that privilege. I think... Not Luther, but John Calvin. I made a mistake. Please excuse me. Martin Luther came. He lived before John Calvin. So John Calvin also was a great... He was a part of this continuation of Lutheranism. So Calvinism was somewhat different because of his predestination and so on. But then John Calvin, who was himself a reformer, was responsible for instigating the burning at stake of another Protestant who was a Spanish theologian. His name was Cervantes, who had a slightly different opinion. He's supposed to be the original exponent or the first exponent of Unitarianism who questioned the Holy Trinity concept of Christianity. So you can find devotion to God doesn't necessarily make you a broad-minded human being. So what does it mean? So devotion should find its fulfillment in identity of God who is present everywhere. Then only we become a spiritual human being. So non-dualistic approach is an approach that focuses on the ultimate experience of seeing God everywhere. This sort of things happen in India also. Everywhere you find people who fought, did violence in the name of God and in the name of devotion to their God. So the more you are devoted to your God, the more you become intolerant towards all other people who worship a different kind of God. So it happened in the case of John Calvin, who instigated the burning at stake of Cervantes, and in the anti-Semitism of Martin Luther. You find all this. So also in India, for example, there was a lot of intolerance, not so much of violence, but intolerance at that time between the Shaktas, Saivas, Vaishnavas, and so on. They were all devotees of God. They were also fighting. Why? Because devotion as such doesn't necessarily take you to the highest spiritual experience unless that devotion is supported by jnanam or advaita. That's why Sri Ramakrishna says bhakti should be always, okay, devotion should always be supported, enriched, and spiritually invigorated by an element of non-dualism or jnanam. Because as you go beyond the mechanical rituals, dogmas and doctrines, external practices, mythologies, even philosophical discussions and theological debates, and when you reach the level of experience, then you find God is the same reality present in everyone, in everything. So that is not a kind of conviction or an intellectual concept. It is a matter of experience. So that's why I can just there's a very famous statement in the words of Shankaracharya, who is the most prominent, rather the original exponent of Advaita, non-dualism. He lived in 8th century AD. He did not originate non-dualism, because non-dualistic philosophy, Advaita, could be found in the ancient Rigvedic literature, in all the other three Vedas, in many scriptures like Yoga Vasishta, Adhyatma Ramayana, Ashtavakra Samhita, Avadhuta Gita, and so on. But Shankaracharya makes a very famous statement. It is frequently quoted in all the dialectical, polemical works of Advaita philosophy, which is the first great statement which tells you that the highest non-dualistic experience is non-different from the highest devotion to a personal God. The verse is, it comes in the 13th chapter, it's the 10th verse. Maicha ananya yogena bhakti ravyabhijarini vivikta desu sevittum anabhirjana samsati. This is the original verse. What it means is, what is the highest, purest, most exquisite devotion? So that devotion is this. Devotion to me. Here, my means to that all-pervading supreme reality. So devotion to that all-pervading, immanent, divine reality present everywhere, without any wavering, without any deviation, without any conflict, one-pointed and highly focused. That is the purest devotion. And such a devotee would like to meditate on that divine reality sitting in an isolated place, because that devotee will see the presence of God, whom he is worshipping outside, actually sitting within his own heart. So the great commentary is this. Maicha ishware ananyayogena apritak samadhina na anyo bhagavato vasudevat paraha asti ataha sa eva no gitihi idi evam nischida avibhicharini buddhi ananyayogaha tena bhajanam bhaktihi na vibhicharana sila avibhicharini sachaknyanam. I'm just quoting. If you won't miss anything, because I will translate and expand the meaning, so you won't miss. But then it is very important when you expound a great idea from an ancient scripture. If we don't quote it, it is somewhere said in the scripture, it won't make any sense according to our tradition. So Shankaracharya says, he says, Maicha Ishware Anyayogena Pradak Samadhina. So true devotion is pure devotion, without any change, without any deviation, without any conflict to God, without any deviation. And then Shankaracharya Sacha Jnanam, that itself is the highest non-dualistic experience or truth, Jnanam. So what is the highest non-dualistic experience? Devotion without any wavering to the presence of that divine reality residing not in a concrete structure, but within our own heart. So actually, the residential address of God is our own heart, the heart of a pure devotee. That is the residential address. You may go everywhere. It doesn't mean that other means are wrong. Remember, that's an important point. Remember, it doesn't mean that going to a place of worship, doing external rituals, is wrong. Not at all. They are all right. They are fine. They are needed. Just as you need to start your education by going to a kindergarten, the primary school, then city college, then maybe Harvard if you are lucky enough. But then if you go to kindergarten and say, well, this is the end of education, then you are not going to be a really educated person. You can go to kindergarten, but in order to avoid the wrong notion, the misunderstanding that there is no education beyond this, you should know at the beginning itself, my goal is to reach Harvard. Then only you will work hard and try to get a good grade in primary school. Like that, a devotee who is praying to God, who practices external rituals, who pray, all these are fine. But remember, the end and the goal, the ultimate purpose of all these practices is to see the presence of God even outside the place of worship. The ultimate goal should be to reach Harvard, not end up education in the kindergarten nearby, like that. Now, what is the practical benefit of this non-dualistic approach to devotion? It saves you from becoming a fanatic. Because our understanding of an anthropomorphic God is very often a creation of the cultural, socio-anthropological conventions into which the particular tribe who conceives this God lives. For example, if you try to analyze different religious thought systems, you find the attributes you associate with the God, with the concept of God of a particular religion, have something to do with the culture in which people who conceived such an idea of God live. If you read the Bible, you can see the beautiful pastoral setting, the parables, the legacy of the Jewish heritage into which Jesus was born. So all this pastoral setting, all that you find, if you read the Bible or the parables. But if you read the Sermon on the Mount, it can be a part of any universal spiritual literature. It could also be part of Vedantic, the highest Vedantic literature. But if you read the earlier portions, in any religion, it is true. There's a lot of socio-anthropological factors, conventions involved in the whole narrative, or even in conceiving an idea of God in a culture. But if you look beyond the socio-anthropological, the secondary details, then you find they all point to a higher concept of reality. But suppose you insist that God should be eating this kind of food, he should be wearing this kind of cloth, which actually, it is actually a superimposition, an interpretation of God by a particular culture or group. And if you impose that concept of God on the whole humanity, people living in other places, following different socio-anthropological conventions, then it'd be totally wrong. That's why very often devotion to a personal God without a non-dualistic element in it can lead to fanaticism. That's why the commentator says, Vivikteshu chahi deheshu chittam prasidadi yata tada atmadi bhavana vivikte ubajayadi ato vivikta devasevitam jnanamuchyade. So, the idea of a supreme reality that could be approached by all people, no matter what traditions, what external practices or conventions they follow, that idea is a special contribution of non-dualistic philosophy or Advaita to world religious thought. Now, I shall try to explain this after giving some preliminary introduction of what Advaita actually is all about. Now, the essence of Advaita philosophy can be outlined in just a few words. First is First, Advaita says, non-dualistic philosophy says, there is an all-pervading reality. It is also immanent, as I mentioned earlier, who is present in all of us. That reality is technically called by the name Brahman. Brahman is not a name of God or anything. Very often it is written Brahman is not. Brahman is not a name of a God. God doesn't have a form or name or anything. You have to use a term, that's all. In fact, the word Brahman means something vast, expansive, all-accommodating, all-including, comprehensive. That's the meaning of the root, Sanskrit root, brahm, from which this particular word derives. So, for that reason, this particular word Brahman is used. Atman. Atman is an interpretation of the same reality when it is conceived to be present in all of us. So the all-pervading, omnipresent reality is also the immanent reality within us. So that reality is conceived to be omnipresent through immanence. So it's called Brahman. And that Brahman is only absolute reality in the world, because it existed in the past. It did not come into existence in the past, because it always existed. And it will never cease to exist. So it is beyond birth, beyond existence, beyond growth, beyond evolution, beyond decay, beyond death. You may be confused when I use the word existence. The word existence here means coming into existence. So that's the empirical sense in which the word, well, it came into existence. Means from a state of non-existence, it came into state of existence. In that sense, you cannot say Brahman came into existence, because that will imply that Brahman did not exist before it came into existence. Which means it always existed, so it cannot come into existence. It always existed in the past, so it cannot come into existence. If you are always here, then you cannot come here again. It's all pervading. And again, it doesn't grow, it doesn't evolve, it doesn't decay, it never dies, because it is immortal reality. And that divine reality is present in all of us. Our worship, our puja, confession, Sabbath, prayer, all these are very good, very much necessary. Just as going to primary school is necessary if you want to eventually go to Harvard. Like that, all other practices, belief in God, reading scriptures, unselfish service to others, leading a pure life, all these are essential. Because these practices prepare our mind to see the presence of God within our hearts, and also experience the presence of the same God everywhere. Just as going to kindergarten or primary school, trying to get a high grade is necessary for you one day to go to Harvard. So the second principle is this world that you see all around us. What about this empirical world? It is only a comparative reality. It is only relative existence. It is relatively unreal or relatively real. Both are the same. In the sense, they are subject to changes. They go on changing. Anything that is subject to changes is real only in a relative sense, not real in the absolute sense. So if you want to call something absolutely real, it should remain the same in the past, in the present, in future, without any change. Trishu kaleshu yat na vyabhicharati tadeva satyam. Whatever is there in this world, which never changes, and you can't say this world of empirical experiences is real in that sense, because every moment, at least every thousands of years, this universe undergoes some very radical changes in terms of climate, in terms of many other factors. So anything which changes is called mithya, in the sense, is only relatively real in the sense, because it changes. And then the third important principle is our real identity, the real self, Atman. That means the reality, the real I, that's not the body, the mind, or the intellect, but it is something that transcends the physical, the intellectual, the mental dimensions of a personality. That Atman is non-different from this all-pervading Brahman. These are three fundamental doctrines of Advaita Vedanta. Now here, very often, you know, there is a lot of misunderstandings about Advaita or non-dualism. It's a very serious misunderstanding. I had to share platforms in India where some ignorant politicians started saying, oh, non-dualism, Advaita says, you are not there, I am not here, this public address system is not here, this podium is not here. This is what Advaita says. Absolute, it's totally laughable. But that's not the view of Advaita. Advaita says, this podium won't be there maybe after 1,000 years. And it was not here maybe before 50 years before, because it must have been manufactured maybe 30, 40 years back. So all these belong to time. I mean, it comes into existence sometime in the past, exists maybe for a few decades. This cosmos, the universe may exist maybe for several billions of years, but still it is within time. So it is only a relative reality, not an absolute reality. An insect may live for a few seconds or minutes. This cosmos may be for 13 billion years. What was its condition before Big Bang? And what will be its condition after Big Crunch, so to speak? So it undergoes changes. So anything which undergoes changes is only relative. So Vedanta doesn't say, or Advaita doesn't say, non-dualistic philosophy doesn't say that the world is not existing. Very often, this serious misunderstanding was caused by many translations all over the world. See, I can give one example. It is from Shankaracharya. There is a very interesting verse in Shankara. The verse is, na punyam, na papam, na saukhyam, na dukkham, na mantro, na tirtham, na veda, na yajnyaham, aham bhojanam, naiva bhojyam, na bhokta, shivananda rupa, shivoham, shivoham. The literal meaning, if you read, and if you don't understand the correct meaning, you will go crazy, if you are not already crazy. What it means is this: no merit, no demerit, no pain, no pleasure, no ritual, no recitation of mantras, no Vedas, no practices. What it means is, all these things are not absolutely real. That's the meaning. It doesn't say that these things do not exist in front of us. So the empirical reality is not denied in Advaita. And for your information, if you are interested in comparative philosophy, there is only one philosophy in the world which completely denies the existence of empirical reality. That is Yogacara system of Buddhism. It's one of the two schools of idealism. Yogacara's system is called Vijnanavada, according to them, all these phenomena, they are totally unreal. It is a kind of, it's a prelude to Berkeley's subjective idealism. Berkeley's subjective idealism or goes a little more wild, that's all. This. So, in fact, Shankaracharya, the great teacher of Advaita, he takes pains to refute this kind of subjective idealism of Yogacara philosophers in his Brahma Sutra Bhashya. He says, you cannot totally deny the reality of empirical experiences. That's what Shankaracharya says. They are not totally unreal. They are not absolutely real, that's all. In the sense, they are subject to changes. So you cannot call them to be absolutely real. As I mentioned, this is a very interesting point. Remember, we a lot of misunderstanding among the philosophical circles. You can find, in fact, the first great Indian saint and philosopher in modern times who tried to correct this misunderstanding was Swami Vivekananda, who delivered a lecture in London on Advaita. Here, especially some of the Jnana Yoga lectures were delivered in London, where Vivekananda pointed out a very serious error that occurred during the later part of 18th century when they translated some of the Advaitic texts into European languages. So Swami Vivekananda says the word mithya or maya, which actually means relativity, something that exists in the relative sense, not absolutely real, but not absolutely unreal either. This was translated into English, the English word illusion, by some of the early translators. When they translated into German, they used a word in German which roughly translates into English as illusion. So, Vivekananda was the first great modern thinker who tried to rectify this error in his London lectures. So, mithya is not illusion. Mithya is only relativity. So, as even Brahma Satyam Jagat Mithya Jivo Brahma Eva Napara. That will take us to another important aspect of Advaita. So in Advaitic tradition, there are four levels, four approaches to reality. The one, as I mentioned earlier, the absolute reality. What is absolutely real, that never changes, because it never comes into existence, because it always exists. So it never ceases to exist, because it always exists. It is called Trigala Abhadhida, Shadvikara, Dida, Avasthatraya, Abhadhida, and so on. Anyway, that means something which is beyond changes related to time, space, and causation remains the same throughout. Jayade, Asti, Vardhade, Viparinamade, Apakshiyade, Vinasyade. Mean come into existence from a state of non-existence into existence, existing for some time, growing, evolving, decaying, disappearing, which all apply to this empirical, phenomenal world. But Brahman or Atman is absolute reality which beyond all these changes and remains the same in the past, present, and future. It is experienced the same in the three states of experience, like waking state, dream state, and deep sleep stage. So this is one reality. At the highest, the top. Then there is something else. It's opposite. Things that cannot even be conceived of as existing. So the examples are given, you know, in the old Vedantic books like Vandhyaputra, Shashavishana. See, the son of a barren woman. But the word itself is a conflict, contradiction in terms. The horns of a hare. Hare doesn't have horns. If it has horns, it cannot be hare. It could be something else. Maybe cow or whatever it is. It cannot be hare. So, something which you cannot even intellectually conceive of. Even if you use the word, the inner contradiction will deny its reality. It's called tuccha, or totally, absolutely inconceivable. It's called asat. So the highest reality, Brahman, is called Sat. Its opposite is absolute unreality. something that you cannot even conceive of. Then there is something else which I mentioned, these empirical experiences. These San Francisco Bay buildings, bridge, all these exist. They are real. But real maybe for hundreds of years or thousands of years or maybe for a few hours. Only, I mean, real only in a very relative sense. So they belong to the category of comparative unreality or comparative reality. Real in a comparative sense, unreal also in a comparative sense. Shankaracharya, Vedanta, Advaita never denies this. As I mentioned earlier, the only philosophical school that denies is maybe Berkeley's subjective idealism, you know, experience and reality, the classical work, or the works of Yogacara or Vijnanavada schools, Asanga, Dignaga, many of the great Indian Buddhist philosophers who lived the 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th centuries in India. They also had this kind of a system of philosophy which denies outright these empirical experiences because they are subjective. Every moment you perceive them, every kshana, every moment it changes, so it's totally unreal. Then there is something else which is not such a pradibhasika. So the absolute reality is called paramarthika, the absolute unreality is called asat, and empirical reality is called vyavahariga. There is a phenomenal reality. See, for example, when you look in front of a mirror, you may see your own reflection. The reflection is not unreal, but it has no existence independent of you. If you are standing in front of a mirror, then only you can see it. So it's only phenomenal experience. So these are four levels of understanding reality in Advaita. But Advaita says, if you conceive of God as somebody who creates this world, who listens to your prayers, who is happy when you do worship, that is real. True, no doubt about it. Just as this empirical experience are real. But when you transcend to a higher level, then you find the God whom you are worshipping in a temple is actually sitting within your own heart. So there is an evolution at the level of our concept of God, and parallel to that, there is an evolution at the level of all of us as we evolve more and more in spiritual life. As we ascend this ladder of spiritual evolution, our reading of God, our understanding of God, our perception of God also evolves. That's why at the beginning, we all think God will be happy if you do things in a certain manner. But you should stick to that high ethical principle. And as we evolve in our own spiritual life, you are able to think of God even when you are not in a temple or a church. So seeing God outside the temple, outside the church, outside the place of worship, in other words, spiritualizing the secular, the ability to practice even secular activities as if it is a spiritual worship, spiritual sadhana, that is characteristic of the most highly evolved spiritual seeker who has reached the Advaitic level of devotion. So devotion itself has an Advaitic dimension. Devotion has a dualistic dimension. When you think God is happy when I go to my temple, God will be terribly unhappy if I fail one day. That's okay. Like kindergarten boy who thinks, well, I have finished my education if I come out of the kindergarten. But as we evolve further and further in our own spiritual life, then we are able to think of God even when we are involved in our day-to-day activities, even when we are in the midst of our secular activities. So the ability to spiritualize the secular is the real characteristic, the sign of a spiritually evolved person. The opposite also, unfortunately, true. Secularizing the spiritual. And that is responsible for most of our problems, you know. So those who stop at a lower level, they want to bring the ideal to their level, and they try to secularize the spiritual. That is responsible for all the problems in the name of God and religion. Spiritualizing the secular is the real answer. So, in fact, I can try to elaborate this great statement of Shankaracharya in the light of other commentators. There was a great metaphysician in India who belonged to the Advaitic tradition of Shankaracharya. In fact, his name was Madhusudana Saraswati. So he lived in, lived and studied in Benares. He was born in East Bengal, but later he studied Advaita in Benares. There's a place where he had to go there to study Advaita. And he wrote a very famous book. In fact, he's known as the great author of Advaita Siddhi, which is a very advanced, not dialectical, polemical work in Vedantic tradition. But one of his most important works was his interpretation of Bhagavad Gita in the light of Shankaracharya's commentary. He was a devotee of Shankaracharya, and he was, of course, a great follower of Shankaracharya's Advaitic tradition. I shall tell you a few things about the history of the polemical, dialectical, this confrontation between different schools of philosophers from, let's say, 9th century AD to 16th century. So after Shankaracharya's passing away, the Advaita tradition was highly misunderstood, and there were other philosophers from the dualistic and qualified dualistic, Dvaita, Visishta Advaita traditions, who questioned Advaita, who wanted to stick to a very, very rigid dualistic pattern of religious philosophy. So, in answer to their refutations and arguments, Madhusudana Saraswati wrote a famous book on Gita. It's called the Gurdartha Deepika. It is a great commentary on Bhagavad Gita, following the footsteps of Shankaracharya's commentary. What he did was, he brought into focus the devotional element of Shankaracharya's system. And he emphasizes an important point. Ishvara anugraha deva pumsam advaita vasana mahabhaya paritrana ditranam eva jayate. It's a very famous Ishvara anugraha deva pumsam advaita vasana. Even to get an academic or spiritual interest in non-dualistic system of philosophy, you need the grace of God. Grace of God is a concept related to bhakti or devotion. You know, God's grace is a natural expression among devotees. So even to understand devotion from a non-dualistic standpoint, you need to practice devotion, and you need the grace of God, whom you pray to, whom you meditate on, whom you worship. Then only you will be able to develop an interest in non-dualistic approach, non-dualistic interpretation of devotion. So that's a very, very, very profound statement, you know. Athabhi anugraha deva tarunendu shikhamanehi advaita vasana pumsam avibhavati nanyatha. Appaya Dikshita was also a great Advaitin who followed Shankaracharya's tradition. He's a great devotee of Shankaracharya. He says, Athabhi anugraha deva tarunendu shikhamanehi. So he also says, without the grace of God, no one can evolve to the higher levels of devotion. I can give an example in this context. If you read the teachings or works of great mystics in non-Vedantic tradition, either Sufis or maybe the great Russian Orthodox mystics, or even the writings of Spanish or German or Italian mystics of Middle Ages, St. Teresa of Avila or St. John of the Cross, any of you find. You find their approach to God is qualitatively different from the approach of an ordinary priest who is part of an ecclesiastical hierarchy. How do you explain this difference? See, when you are part of a structure, an ecclesiastical hierarchy, they become part of people, not me, but you know, Gibbons, who wrote the history of Rome, Decline and Fall of Roman Empire, his own conclusion was Christianity, instead of Christianizing the Romans, Christianity itself was Romanized when Constantine became the emperor of Roman Empire and he imposed Christianity. So he talks about the superstructure of the ecclesiastical superstructure, which is nothing but an ecclesiastical adaptation of the Roman imperial structure. Anyway, I'm not going to that subject. Point is, the teachings, the intimacy of their experiences, the intimate contact they seem to have had with God, with Jesus, that you reflect, that you find reflected in the writings of maybe the Way of Pilgrim, or the Pilgrim Continues His Journey, is a great Russian mystical writing belonging to the 19th century, or St. Teresa of Avila, St. John of Cross, any of these great, or even a person like, you know, Don Bosco, who was actually responsible for starting a movement for training orphan boys in the streets. So you find in their writings, you find a more intimate understanding of the essence of religion than you come across in the writings of the ecclesiastical hierarchy. That's because the former, these mystics, are able to ascend beyond the superstructure. There is that the mark of a more intimate understanding of the experience aspect of religion in the writings of mystics, which normally do not associate in the normal sermons of a hierarchy of that. One example you can check for yourself. If you read The Way of a Pilgrim, as I mentioned earlier, it's a marvelous small book. Aaron French has translated from Russian into English. The pilgrim was practically a simple, poor villager who happened to listen to a sermon on the St. Paul's first epistle and happened to hear about the Jesus prayer. And he wanted to learn the meaning of Jesus prayer, and he started his journey in search of a teacher. His plan was to go to Jerusalem, go to Odessa, then to Jerusalem. And while traveling, he met one Russian Orthodox monk who took him to his cell in the monastery and taught him the secret of Jesus' prayer. And when this pilgrim, he was not a great scholar of theology, he could just barely write, read and write. When he listened, went and learned and mastered the practice of Jesus' prayer, he explains how he felt. He felt a complete identity with the whole humanity around him. He felt so much of joy within. Something suddenly came alive within him. And also it overflowed as a great joy and compassion and love for his fellow beings. He felt the presence of Jesus in everyone. So you have to remember, non-dualistic experience could happen, it did happen in many other traditions. So wherever a great spiritual teacher or a seeker transcended the early stages of spiritual evolution, like rituals, mythology, and philosophy, and reached the realm of inner experience, which actually makes what makes you from really transforms you from a religious person to a spiritual person, then he felt a much more intimate understanding of the essence of God and reality. So Advaitic experience, one way or other, could be found in the writings and the lives of many great mystics in all traditions. Only the language used to express that experience could be different. The vocabulary will be different. The language and vocabulary, the parables and illustrations have a lot to do with the place where they are born, the cultural surroundings in which they live. But actually, this transcending to the level of experience, going beyond rituals, beyond mythologies, beyond dogmas, beyond do's and don'ts, and towards the inner intimate experience. This idea is what is Advaita is all about. That's what non-dualism is all about. You can find this in the writings and in the lives of many great saints and mystics in all traditions. So I have tried to give you a bit superficial overview of a great spiritual philosophical tradition. Maybe sometime later on another occasion we shall continue. Thank you. Namaskar. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Panamastu.